he saw. Men with grievous wounds were lying on the floor, their blood-soaked bandages unchanged for hours. Unfed, they continually asked for water. When Chuikov asked why of doctors and nurses, they shrugged their inability to cope with the staggering input of casualties. The reply seemed logical, so Chuikov watched an operation, then went out to his jeep and sat brooding about the wounded until the ferry came in and transferred him to the far shore. At 10 a.m. on September 12th, he saluted Andrei Yeremenko and said, "Tovarish Commander, General Chuikov has arrived according to your order." Yeremenko greeted him warmly and offered to share breakfast. When Chuikov refused, the two men talked about general conditions in the Stalingrad area. Outside, an occasional German shell exploded in the nearby trees. "Vasily Ivanovich," Yeremenko got to the point, "I asked for you in order to offer you a new position." Though he had anticipated the new post, Chuikov looked genuinely startled as Yeremenko stared intently at him for a reaction. "The position of commander of the 62nd Army, what do you think of that?" Chuikov responded immediately, "Vi etom et nasheni," in this respect, and Yeremenko remembered that Chuikov was fond of using this phrase in conversation. "The appointment, of course, is extremely responsible." Yeremenko broke in, "The situation of the army is very tense, and I am happy you realize the heavy load you bear." Chuikov nodded. "I think that in this respect, I will not let you down." Satisfied with Chuikov's responses, Yeremenko took him to see Khrushchev, who was quickly convinced that Chuikov meant to stand fast in Stalingrad. The meeting broke up on the implicit understanding that front headquarters would not deny Chuikov help when he asked for it. Then the new commander of the 62nd Army left to collect his belongings before the return trip to the west bank of the Volga. On the same day, General Friedrich von Paulus flew more than 500 miles west to Vinnytsia in the Ukraine. There he spent hours with Adolf Hitler and discussed his chief concern, the left flank along the Don. Paulus asked the Führer to give him some corset units, a reserve for the puppet armies still moving into position. Hitler was most cordial and promised to look into the problem immediately. When he pressed Paulus about Stalingrad, the general told him the city should fall in a matter of days. That evening, Paulus dined with his old friend Franz Halder. Over good wine, they talked of the successful summer steppe campaign, and Paulus repeated his fears about the weakness of the puppet armies on his left flank. Halder told him he intended to keep after Hitler on the subject, and the two men parted on an optimistic note. Meanwhile, the three top men in Soviet military affairs were also in conference. Joseph Stalin, Georgi Zhukov, and Alexander Vasilevsky pored over the critical news coming from the battlefields. They noted that in the Caucasus, German Army Group A was beginning to slow down in its drive for the oil fields. But Stalin, still unsure that he had the strength to contain the enemy there, summed up the problem by saying, "They want to get at the oil of Grozny at any price." Without pause, he added, "Well, now let's see what Zhukov has to say about Stalingrad." Zhukov did not have good news. His northern forces could not break the German corridor from the Don to the Volga. Stalin went to a map and studied his list of reserves in other sectors, while Zhukov and Vasilevsky stood to one side and discussed in hushed tones the possibility of an alternative solution, another way out. Suddenly, Stalin snapped, "What other way out?" Both generals were shocked by his keen hearing. Stalin continued, "Look, you had better get back to the general staff and give some thought to what can be done at Stalingrad and how many reserves we will need to reinforce the Stalingrad group. And don't forget the Caucasus front. We will meet again tomorrow evening at 9. While Stalin and his brain trust maneuvered in Moscow, Vasily Chuikov came ashore in Stalingrad to assume command of the 62nd Army. A rabble ran to meet him. Old men and women, little children crowded around. Faces black with grime, they were a pathetic sight. The whimpering children begged for water, and that bothered Chuikov most of all, for he had none to give them. He drove off to the Tsaritsa Gorge to meet his staff, but the headquarters was empty, and he had to ask soldiers in the streets for directions to the new command post, Someone told him it was on Mamive Hill. Driving there through the wreckage from the bombings and shellings of previous days, he was appalled at the flimsy anti-tank defenses. From his own experience, Chuikov knew the Germans would roll over them in seconds. He noticed something else. Though it was still summer, every leaf had fallen from the trees. Reaching the southeastern slope of Mamive, Chuikov climbed upward and stumbled upon the new headquarters, just a wide trench with a bench of packed earth along one wall and a bed and a table on the other side. The roof was made of brush, covered only by a foot of dirt. Two people were in the dugout, a woman telephone operator and General Nikolai Ivanovich Krylov, a heavy-set man with a serious face. Since Krylov was arguing heatedly on the phone, Chuikov slipped his identification papers onto the table and waited while Krylov glanced casually at them. When he finished his call, the chief of staff of the 62nd Army reached out and shook hands with his new superior. Still very upset about his telephone conversation, Krylov explained that he had just been speaking with an officer who had moved his own headquarters back to the edge of the Volga without permission. In other words, Krylov said, his command post is now behind us. It's disgraceful. Chuikov agreed and sat down. He needed time to grasp the situation. So, for the moment, he did not intrude on Krylov's activities. Toward midnight, the general who had arbitrarily relocated his command post arrived with his deputy. At this point, Chuikov asserted himself as army commander and berated the man. What would your attitude be as a Soviet general in command of a military sector if one of your subordinate commanders and headquarters left the front without your permission? How do you regard your own action? The general and his deputy hung their heads and did not reply. Chuikov kept lashing out at them, accusing them of cowardice. Before dismissing them, he demanded they return to their former position by 4 a.m. Then the outraged Chuikov went back to a study of the tactical maps. The arrows on them pointed to disaster. Less than half a mile away, troops of the German 71st and 295th Divisions were about to lunge toward the vital main ferry linking Stalingrad with the far shore. At 6:30 a.m. on September 13th, the enemy attacked, and, with communications among his ground units frequently cut by explosions, Chuikov had great difficulty in maintaining control of the battle. By late afternoon, he had almost completely lost contact with the troops, but the Germans still had not been able to break into the downtown section of Stalingrad. Exposed to incessant gunfire on Mamive and deprived of normal telephone and radio circuits, Chuikov suddenly told everyone in the crowded trench to pack up and leave for the Tsaritsa Gorge bunker, so hastily abandoned in recent days. Following their orders of the night before, Marshals Vasilevsky and Zhukov were again closeted with Stalin. After shaking hands with them, an unusual thing for the premier to do, Stalin launched into an attack on his allies. Tens and hundreds of thousands of Soviet people are giving their lives in the fight against fascism, and Churchill is haggling over 20 hurricanes. And those hurricanes aren't even that good. Our pilots don't like them. Without pausing, Stalin asked, "Well, what did you come up with? Who's making the report?" "Either of us," Vasilevsky said. "We are of the same opinion." Stalin looked at their map and asked, "What have you got here?" "These are our preliminary notes for a counteroffensive at Stalingrad," Vasilevsky answered. Zhukov and Vasilevsky then took turns explaining their idea. After breaking through both the German flank defenses 100 miles northwest of the city along the Don River and 50 miles south of the city around the Zatsa chain of salt lakes, two Russian pincers would then meet near the town of Kalach. Hopefully, they would trap most of Paulus's 6th Army in the 40-mile-wide land bridge between the Don and Volga. Stalin objected, "Aren't you extending your striking forces too far?" When the marshals disagreed with him, he said, "We will have to think about this some more and see what our resources are." While they argued the merits of the bold plan, General Yeremenko called from Yami on the Bodo Line, and Stalin listened intently to the news that the Germans were entering Stalingrad from the west and south. When Stalin hung up, he turned to Vasilevsky. "Issue orders immediately to have Redimsev's 13th Guards Division cross the Volga and see what else you can send across the river tomorrow." the three men parted with this warning from the premier: "We will talk about our plan later. No one except the three of us is to know about it." On the morning of September 14th, the German 71st Division entered downtown Stalingrad on a two-mile-wide front. Captain Gerhard Münch personally led the 3rd Battalion, 194th Infantry Regiment, as it tried to cross several city blocks and gain the river front. Until now, his men had suffered mostly from the heat or occasional Russian rear guards, and Münch thought their chances of reaching the Volga before nightfall were excellent. But once they reached the congested avenues of the city, casualties rose sharply. From third and fourth floor windows, snipers riddled the columns, and hidden light artillery blew gaps in the ranks. The Germans found few places to hide, for they always had to force the battle and dig the enemy from the ruins of buildings. Still, by 2 p.m., the 3rd Battalion had closed to within a few hundred yards of the main railroad station just off Red Square, and Münch received orders to seize the ferry landing at the Volga. Despite mounting losses, he still felt confident. His men had captured several Russian couriers running through the streets with handwritten messages. Sensing that the Soviet 62nd Army's telephone communications had broken down and that it was now increasingly dependent on isolated small groups to contain the Germans, Münch assumed that his depleted battalion could manage the last half mile toward their goal. Münch's estimate of enemy problems was amazingly accurate. General Chuikov was in a desperate situation. Back again in the underground bunker at Tsaritsa Gorge, he had just been told that the 13th Guards Division would come to his aid and cross the river that night. But in the meantime, he had to find enough troops to hold the main ferry landing. Without the ferry, the center of Stalingrad was sure to fall. Around 4 p.m., Chuikov called in Colonel Sarayev, the NKVD garrison commander. General Krylov had already warned Chuikov about Sarayev's attitude. He considers himself indispensable and does not like carrying out the army's orders. When Sarayev arrived in the bunker, Chuikov sized up his guest and dealt with him bluntly. "Do you understand that your division has been incorporated into the 62nd Army and that you have to accept the authority of the Army Military Council?" When Sarayev grumbled and looked annoyed, Chuikov made the ultimate threat. "Do you want me to telephone the Front Military Council to clarify the position?" Faced with a reprimand or worse from Yeremenko and Khrushchev, Sarayev caved in and humbly answered, "I am a soldier of the 62nd Army." Chuikov sent him to organize his 1,500 militiamen into squads of 10 and 20 in strategic buildings in the heart of the city. These storm groups were his answer to the German superiority in troops, artillery, and planes, especially planes. Throwing away the Red Army textbook on tactics, he was substituting an idea he had first conceived on the steppe, where he watched enemy blitzkrieg tactics against the 64th Soviet Army, and became convinced that he could not compete against German firepower. He countered by creating a series of mini-fortresses, commanding various street intersections. The small storm groups could act as breakwaters, funneling Nazi panzers into approach roads already registered on by Russian artillery. When the tanks lumbered along these predictable routes, they would face a murderous fire from heavy weapons. With the tanks bogged down, the storm group could then deal with German infantry, exposed behind the flaming armor. And by fighting at such close range, the storm groups also eliminated the threat of the German Luftwaffe. Afraid to bomb their own troops, the Stukas and Ju-88s would be unable to attack the Soviet strongpoints. A mere half-mile northeast of Chuikov's bunker, a group of NKVD soldiers braced for the final German thrust to the river. Drawn up in an arc around the main ferry, the 60 soldiers waited for their commander, Colonel Petrikov, to return from a scouting mission along Pensenskaya Street. To figure out where the enemy was trying to break through, Petrikov and two aides walked as far north as the 9th of January Square. The roar of small arms fire was rolling over them from a distance, but they had neither seen a German nor heard any close-range shooting. The square was deserted, and Petrikov stood beside an abandoned car to assess his situation. Submachine gun bullets suddenly whistled through the car windows, forcing Petrikov to duck for cover. Almost instantly, German shells exploded up and down the square, and he was knocked unconscious. Rescued by his men, he awoke in a tunnel at the edge of the Volga, where he lay under an overcoat, and heard that the Germans had rushed for the river and taken a series of buildings near the shore. From the House of Specialists, an apartment house for engineers, from the five-story State Bank, and from the beer factory, the Germans were hollering, "Rus, Rus, Volga, Bul, Bul! Russians will drown in the Volga." Petrikov staggered to the tunnel entrance and looked out at the river for some sign of the 13th Guards Division. But the time for their crossing was still hours away, and he had to keep the Germans from the ferry until then. When a small Russian boy wandered into the tunnel, the curious Petrikov asked his name. "Kolya," he replied, and told the colonel that the enemy had sent him to spy on Russian strength between the House of Specialists and the Volga. Petrikov smiled and asked Kolya to tell him instead about the Germans. Kolya knew exactly who his captors were. The 1st Battalion, 194th Infantry Regiment, 71st Division, commanded by a Captain Ginderling, protecting Gerhard Munch's left flank. Ginderling was also trying to sweep to the main ferry before dark. As dusk approached, Ginderling sent his troops from the beer factory toward the ferry pier, just 750 yards away. Petrikov's 60 men formed a skirmish line around the landing, fighting hard although their ammunition was dangerously low. Suddenly, a motorboat appeared from across the Volga, carrying cases of ammunition and grenades. Resupplied, Petrikov's NKVD soldiers now prepared to counterattack. The colonel had found a 76mm gun on a side street, and while he tried to learn its parts, he issued the order to move out when he fired the fifth shot from his new artillery piece. Petrikov aimed the weapon at the State Bank, loaded the first shell very carefully, and shot directly into the cement building. As he readied another round, a launch chugged in behind him carrying men of the 13th Guards, but the Germans had seen them too, and the launch was quickly surrounded by explosions. Bracketed by gunfire, Colonel Yelin, commander of the Guards' 42nd Regiment, jumped off the boat into knee-deep water and ran up the embankment. When he met Petrikov and heard that he was firing at the State Bank, Yelin angrily told him to stop because his own men were about to storm the building for hand-to-hand combat. The situation was still perilous, but no Russian was aware of one significant fact. The Germans attempting to drown them in the river were themselves on the verge of collapse. Near the railroad station, Captain Munch counted his ranks and realized that one day's fighting in Stalingrad had cost him most of his battalion. Almost 200 of his men lay dead or wounded on the streets leading to Red Square. Now the railroad station was an even more deadly obstacle. Although the Russians had not yet occupied it in strength, Munch was instinctively afraid of it. Hidden inside its vast network of tracks, cabooses, and freight cars, a small group of snipers could tear his reduced force to pieces. He decided to bypass it and called in an airstrike. It came quickly, but the Stukas missed the target and dropped their bombs in the midst of Munch's troops. As darkness fell, the captain assembled his battalion in the U-shaped, unfinished government house where, from the terrace, he first saw the Volga. He made another head count and found he had less than 50 men left to take the ferry. Recognizing that his 3rd Battalion no longer had the power to accomplish that on its own, Munch told his soldiers to take cover and settle in for the night. Barely 500 yards from Munch's U-shaped building, the 13th Guards were now ashore in strength. Two regiments and one battalion from another regiment made it across the Volga through the shellfire, landed, and ran up the gradual incline directly into battle. In the dark, the Russians got lost and stumbled over the wreckage of previous days, but they managed to form a defense line before dawn. On Mamaev Hill, squads and platoons dug frantically into the side of the former picnic grounds. But the German 295th Division had already taken the crest where two green water towers provided a sheltered command post. The noise on Mamaev was dreadful. One Russian soldier likened it to two steel needles pressing in on his eardrums and reaching into the brain. The sky was ripped by explosions that turned faces a dull red, and to Colonel Yelin, it seemed everyone was about to die. Somehow, the Russians managed to hold the hillside. Casualties were enormous. Yelin had to send in men piecemeal to fill holes torn in the line. Soldiers never knew their comrades' names before dying together in the scooped-out ground. At his headquarters, Chuikov tried to gauge the situation on the hill, but could not because of contradictory information. He also had other problems. His command post along the Tsaritsa Gorge was under siege. At the Pushkinskaya street entrance, messengers and staff ran in and out. Some men entered just to escape the bullets and shells tearing through the air. The heat in the bunker was unbearable. Drenched with sweat, several times Chuikov walked out into the fresh air to maintain his equilibrium. German machine gunners fired close to him, but he did not mind. The bedlam inside the shelter seemed worse. From the meadowland on the far shore of the Volga, the commander of the 13th Guards was about to cross into Stalingrad. 36-year-old General Alexander Ilyich Radimsev was no stranger to war. Under the pseudonym Pavlito Geshos, he had gone to Spain in 1936 and fought with the loyalists against Franco. Named a hero of the Soviet Union for that exploit, he now paced the river's edge and could not believe what he saw. On the western bank, Stalingrad burned brightly in the sunrise of September 15th. The boats carrying his troops to the city were being chopped to pieces by artillery fire. While Rodimtsev watched, one craft was suddenly engulfed in smoke, and then an ear-splitting explosion spread out from it for 100 yards. When fountains of water fell back into the river, the boat and its 65 occupants had vanished. Radimtsev and his staff boarded their own launch and crouched below the gunwales as it backed slowly into the current. Shrapnel beat against the wood, and geysers of spray washed over them from near misses. But the launch made it to the main ferry, and Radimtsev jumped off and ran north a quarter mile to his command post in Colonel Petrikov's old tunnel, a poorly ventilated corridor with a ceiling formed from old planks. As dirt showered down on him from explosions, Radimtsev met his advance party and learned that the Germans seemed to be trying to seize 3 miles of riverfront from Tsaritsa Gorge up to Mamaev Hill. Anxious to report to Chuikov, the general took 5 staff officers with him, ran down the embankment to the ferry landing, then cut west for a half mile into the underground bunker in the gorge. In that brief journey, shells killed 3 of his companions. Chuikov embraced the dirt-covered Radimtsev and made him sit down while the guards commander quickly briefed him on the status of the reinforcements. Most of his division was already across, but they were short about 2,000 rifles. After Chuikov arranged to fill this need from army reserves, he asked Radimtsev how he felt about the terrible assignment he had been given. "I am a communist," he replied. "I have no intention of abandoning the city." Chapter 10. Soldiers scurried about in a harsh light of raging fires and bursting flares that illuminated the scene like mid-morning on a summer's day. Vasily Chuikov anxiously prowled around the Pushkinskaya street entrance of his bunker to get a breath of air. Spotting an officer, he called out, "Lieutenant, where are your men?" Anton Kuzmich Dragon told the general that he commanded the 1st Company, 1st Battalion, 42nd Regiment, 13th Guards. Chuikov gave him a terrifying order. "Hold the main railroad station." Dragon dutifully assembled his troops and moved toward the concrete terminal just west of Red Square. They came under vicious crossfire from several buildings, and Dragon realized that the Germans were in the station ahead of him. But he kept on, creeping to the left, moving closer to the terminal. After a series of whispered instructions, Dragon and his men rushed the building. Grenades exploded, machine gun tracers split the darkness, and suddenly the Germans were gone. The Russians swiftly scattered into the maze of freight cars and cabooses and waited for the dawn. They had no idea that the Germans around them were suffering 60% casualties. When the Germans burst into the residential section of the city, they came too fast for some civilians. The ferries had evacuated most of the population, including Anastasia Modena and her orphans, Station Master Viskov and his wife, and Pravda editor Vodolagin, but some 3,000 inhabitants still remained. In the suburb of Dargova, the advance caught hundreds of these non-combatants in their homes. Among them was 15-year-old Sasha Filipov and his family. While his parents and 10-year-old brother stayed inside their house, the diminutive, frail Sasha went out to fraternize with the enemy. A master cobbler from his training at trade school, Sasha introduced himself to German officers occupying a nearby building and offered his services to them. Amused at the thought of someone so young and delicate having such a skill, the Germans promised him work soling army boots. Sasha returned home that night with the news that he was going to work for the enemy. He did not tell his parents that he had also contacted Russian intelligence officers and arranged to spy on German headquarters in Dargova. Mrs. Katrina Karmanova was also caught by the swift German advance. She had lingered at home for days, carrying valuables to the backyard for burial. Silver, jewelry, family heirlooms, all were dumped into a hole and covered over. Now, with her son Gen, she listened to the sounds of machine guns at the end of the block and knew she had waited too long to leave. An artillery shell exploded on the roof, setting the house on fire. She and Gen ran next door and hid behind a sofa in the parlor. Grenades popped outside, and then a fiery string of tracer bullets flew through the room. Gen suddenly cried out, "Don't be afraid, Mother. Please pull the bullet out of my arm." With trembling fingers, Mrs. Karmanova picked at the metal and finally removed it. Ripping off a piece of her slip, she fashioned a crude bandage and then shouted, "Let's get out or we'll be killed." They ran into the street and fell into a zigzag trench beside Russian soldiers and civilians. A little girl lay huddled up, her body punctured with shrapnel. She screamed and screamed, "Find my mama before I die." Mrs. Karmanova could not bear it. As she crouched under a hail of bullets and tried to block out the sounds of the dying child, she saw a family dart from shelter and run toward the river. At the same moment, a German sniper tracked them and quickly killed the son, the father, and then the mother. The sole survivor, a little girl, paused in bewilderment over her mother's body. In the trench, Russian soldiers cupped their hands and hollered, "Run! Run!" Others took up the cry. The girl hesitated, then bolted from the corpses into the darkness. The German sniper did not fire again. Throughout the night, Mrs. Karmanova and Gen stayed in the trench. A few yards away, rescuers frantically tried to save several soldiers buried alive by a shell burst. At dawn on September 16th, during a temporary lull, she and Gen jumped up and ran to the Volga. The Germans let them go. In their wooden cottage, 11-year-old Natasha Kornilov and her mother were not as lucky. Wounded days previously by bomb fragments, they lay helpless while German soldiers broke down the front door and stood over them with machine guns. The woman thought they were about to be raped, but the Germans ignored them and ransacked the house for pots, pans, food, even bedding. When they left, Mrs. Kornilov scrawled the word typhus on a board and had Natasha put it up on the door. The ruse backfired. Within hours, a German medical team saw the sign and set fire to the supposedly plague-ridden home. As flames danced around her, Natasha dragged her crippled mother into the backyard and into a concrete storage shack. There, under a thin blanket on the cold floor, the Kornilovs listened to the gunfire from the direction of Red Square and wondered whether anyone would come to their rescue. On September 17th, with Germans pressing in from north and south of the Tsaritsa Gorge, Vasily Chuikov had to seek a new home. All during the day, while bullets ricocheted off rocks and shells exploded outside the Pushkinskaya Street entrance to the bunker, the headquarters staff of the 62nd Army scrambled away toward the main ferry. At midnight, Chuikov and his personal assistants went across the Volga to Krasnaya Sloboda, where they took hot baths and relaxed with food and drink. As the hours passed, Chuikov failed to notice the sunrise. Suddenly panic-stricken, he and his men raced out to catch the ferry back to Stalingrad. The last boat was leaving the dock, and Chuikov sprinted ahead. With a running leap, he fell on board and identified himself to the startled helmsman, who returned to pick up the rest of the army staff at the dock. Several hours later, Chuikov set up a new headquarters 5 miles north of the Tsaritsa Gorge. Just a trench with some boards over it. It was in an open space between the Red October and Barakadi plants. On a slope above their bunker was an oil tank farm and a concrete oil reservoir. According to everyone familiar with the area, the tanks were empty. At 6th Army headquarters in Golubinka, 40 miles west of Stalingrad, German newspapermen badgered General Friedrich von Paulus for permission to flash word home that the city had been taken. Smiling cheerfully, Paulus parried their queries, saying, "Any time now, any time." But in his stifling quarters, the general played his gramophone, smoked endless quantities of cigarettes, and tried to calm his stomach, which was churning with dysentery. He had lost most of his hopes for a quick victory. In Germany, some newspapers printed a special edition with a banner headline, "Stalingrad Gefallen." The papers were bundled for distribution, then held at the last moment, while Goebbels' ministry sought confirmation from Paulus. He could not give it. In Stalingrad's main railroad station, west of Red Square, Lieutenant Anton Dragon's company was enduring ferocious bombing that blew down the walls and buckled the iron girders. When the Germans surrounded him on three sides, Dragon took his men across the street to another building, the nail factory, from which he commanded a good view of the intersection leading east to the Volga. Barely settled in a workshop, Dragon took stock of his supplies and realized he had no food, little ammunition, and no water. In a frantic search for something to quench their thirst, the Russians fired machine guns into drain pipes to see if any liquid remained. There was not a drop. From the Tsaritsa Gorge to the slopes of Mamaev Hill, the German 295th and 71st Divisions were suffering from Chuikov's renewed strength. The 71st Division's intelligence chief, Colonel Gunter von Below, whose brother Nikolaus served Hitler as an air attaché, walked through the devastation near the main railroad station and found it difficult to comprehend the enormity of the destruction. As he carefully sidestepped debris, a master sergeant came to him and pleaded, "What am I going to do? I have only 9 men left." Colonel Below sat beside the distraught man on a curb, and they discussed the toll the Russians had taken of the sergeant's company in past hours. After a while, the sergeant calmed down and went back to his 9 soldiers. Gunter von Below remained, staring at the ruins. Thoroughly shaken, he wondered whether the Russians would collapse before his own division ran out of men. Gunter von Below's main antagonists, the soldiers of the 13th Guards Division, lay in heaps from Mamaev to Red Square. Nearly 6,000 guardsmen had been killed, but they had bought the Russians several days of precious time. One of the fortresses which had slowed the German timetable was the huge grain elevator, whose cement silos rose high on the plain just south of the Tsaritsa Gorge. For nearly a week, since September 14th, a group of less than 50 able-bodied Russians had holed up in the corrugated metal side tower and defied the guns of 3 Nazi divisions. Reinforced on the night of September 17th by Lieutenant Andrei Kozhianov and a platoon of Marines dressed in striped shirts and navy hats, the garrison fought with renewed spirit, the men joking with each other while shells whistled through their hideout. Once, a German tank had approached, and under a white flag, an officer and interpreter cautiously asked for their surrender to the heroic German army. The Russians shouted, "Go to hell," warning the intruders to leave the tank behind and get out. When the Germans tried to jump into the vehicle, the Marines blew it up. For the next 3 days, German artillery pounded the stronghold, set the grain on fire with incendiary shells, and riddled the tower itself with high explosives. German infantrymen broke in and crept up the stairs, but the defenders managed to drive them back with knives, fists, and bullets. Now, on the night of September 20th, the exhausted garrison was almost out of ammunition, and the water supply had been used up completely. In a frantic search for something to drink, Lieutenant Kozhianov led his men out the tower door, across the field, a main road, and into a gully, where they stumbled on an enemy mortar battery. In the resulting melee, the startled Germans fled, leaving behind gallons of ice-cold water that the Marines gulped down gratefully. Completely dehydrated, Kozhianov suddenly felt faint from the water and collapsed on the ground. When he woke up, he was in a dark cellar. The shoe was gone from his right foot. His shirt was off. His head felt light, and he could not move his arms and legs. Standing guard over him was a soldier from the German 14th Panzer Division. The grain elevator he had defended so heroically had passed into enemy hands. The Germans quickly put out the fires and saved most of the wheat, which would be significant in weeks to come. A mile to the north, in another Russian strong point just off Red Square, Anton Dragin still occupied the nail factory. But when a Russian woman, Maria Vadanaeva, ran through machine gun fire to tell him the Germans were bringing up tanks, he knew his hours there were numbered. On September 21st, Dragin came under intense pressure. Enemy tanks and planes battered the building and forced a wedge between his company and the rest of the 1st Battalion of the 13th Guards, strung out across Red Square. By late afternoon, Dragin was nearly cut off from his countrymen. At the Univermag department store, the Germans concentrated on battalion headquarters and killed nearly every Russian there. Dragin tried to send help, but the headquarters had been demolished and the staff annihilated. Dragin then took command of the battalion and sent a courier back to the Volga with a message for Colonel Yelin, the regimental commander. The courier died on the way and in the 42nd Regiment bunker on the Volga shoreline. Yelin marked the entire 1st Battalion destroyed somewhere in the area of Red Square. But Dragin was still alive. Leading his troops from building to building, he gave ground only when the Germans set fire to his hiding places. The battle raged past the fountain with its statues of children dancing in a circle around a crocodile, past Pravda, the city Soviet, the theater, and the bodies hanging in the hedges around the obelisk commemorating the fallen from the Civil War of 1918. At the intersection of Krasnopeterskaya and Komsomolskaya streets, Dragin brought the remnants of his shattered battalion into a basement of a three-story apartment house. Scattering the surviving 40 men around window openings, he sat behind a heavy machine gun and waited to die. From the far-off Urals, more reinforcements had been rushed to the beleaguered city, and from the farthest reaches of Siberia, the 284th Division, under Colonel Nikolai Batyuk, came with orders to move to the Volga crossing. A Ukrainian of medium height, slim, with dark hair combed straight back, Batyuk suffered from a serious circulatory ailment and frequently had to be carried on the back of one of his aides. He did this only at night, so his troops would not be aware of his weakness. An obviously determined man, on arrival he told Chuikov, "I came here to fight the Nazis, not for a parade." Few in Batyuk's division wanted this battle. Mostly raw recruits, they were willing to fight the Nazis, but not at Stalingrad. Lieutenant Pyotr Deryabin agreed. Already badly wounded at Moscow, he had no illusions about what awaited his men in the burning city. At Krasnofimsk, in the Urals, a hard core of veterans like Deryabin had taught their skills to 18 and 19-year-old boys, most of whom were Orientals from the Mongolian border area and had never seen a German. Then they marched and drove nearly 700 miles westward, chewing the roots of the smolka plant, a licorice-tasting substitute for gum, and gulping down whatever vodka they could find on the way. At Kamishin, they gorged on watermelon, the best grown in Russia and the pride of the town, then climbed into Studebaker trucks, which transported them the rest of the way to the Volga. They began crossing the river on the misty morning of September 22nd. It was hours before the first group landed in the fiery city, and though German planes pounded them, they survived the run in good shape. Deryabin tumbled into the Dolgi Ravine and promptly fell into a troubled sleep. When he awoke, he went on to the Lazar chemical plant in the middle of the railroad loop between the riverbank and the slopes of Mamaev Hill, where the Germans were fighting furiously with the 13th Guards. The crest had changed hands countless times, but the Germans were still able to look down the throats of the new men from the 284th as they took position. Alexei Petrov came across the Volga and was assigned to the northern sector near Ladashenka. For 10 days he had been given hurried instructions in the use of a 120mm cannon, but with time running out, the exasperated instructor finally told him to teach himself. As best he could, Petrov mastered the techniques of firing the heavy weapon that had a range of nearly 6 miles. The squat, wavy-haired sergeant had spent months as a construction worker in Kuibyshev before being drafted. There he unexpectedly met his brother, who told him the rest of his family his mother, father, and sister, had been swallowed up in the Ukraine by the German advance. They had not been heard from in more than a year. When ordered into Stalingrad, Petrov went to the dock and saw that the other shore of the Volga was a solid wall of flames. Though scared to death, he knew he would go across. But other Russians would not, and Petrov watched as NKVD guards fired in the air over the deserters and then killed them when they ran from the landing. After Alexei climbed on board the barge, the NKVD took no further chances. Guards lined the rails to prevent anyone from jumping overboard. Bombers came over, seeking out the steamers and tugs. German mortars behind Mamaev reached out for them, and Petrov cursed the slowness of the voyage as the river froze in a midday tableau. Feeling trapped and vulnerable, he crouched down to hide from shrapnel singing by his ears. Men slipped off the sides to drown. Bullets thudded into flesh, and soldiers sagged against neighbors and died without a word. Petrov saw the Volga water clearly. It was a swirling mixture of water and bright red blood. His boat took nearly 2 hours to reach a landing site under the cliff. While the dead covered the deck, the living scrambled off. Nearly half of Petrov's regiment had died crossing the river. Because most of his unit was already dead, he now had to fight as an infantryman. His baptism to war was brutal. Three scouts went ahead to gauge German strength. Two came back. Petrov picked up his field glasses and scanned no man's land for the missing man. He was out there, spread-eagled on the ground. The Germans had thrust a bayoneted rifle into his stomach and left him face up in the open. Petrov and his squad went berserk. Screaming hoarsely, they jumped from their holes and ran forward. Bursting into a line of houses, they killed anyone who rose before them. When several Germans raised their hands in surrender, Petrov squeezed the trigger of his Tommy gun and killed them all. He came to an elderly Russian soldier bending over a woman. Her jet-black hair streaming back in a carefully arranged way, she seemed to be sleeping. The man was moaning softly. "Dear girl, dear girl, why should a young person like you have to die in such a war?" Alexei Petrov stood beside the couple and cried bitterly as he looked down at the beautiful woman. Then he ran off to kill her tormentors. In the hallway of a house, he listened to a German wailing in one of the downstairs rooms. The soldier prayed, "Oh God, let me live after this war." Petrov rammed the door open and saw a kneeling man who looked up at him pleadingly. Petrov fired into his face. Wild-eyed, he went from floor to floor, smashing open doors, looking for gray-green uniforms. The pounding brought Germans out of different rooms. Petrov shot three more as they ran down the stairs. Exhausted, his anger eased. The house became very still. He stepped over the bodies on the stairway and went out the front door to find his own men. During the afternoon of September 23rd, another contingent from the 284th Division set out from the far shore on barges. 20-year-old Tanya Chernova found space at the edge of a barge and sat down with her knees against her chest for the grim ride. Some of the 150 soldiers on board pleaded with the perky blonde to move into the middle of the group and share some vodka, but she tossed her head in reply and stayed where she was. Tanya had not wanted to be a soldier. As a child, she had worn ballet slippers and practiced pirouettes. Later, she had studied medicine, but when the Germans invaded Russia, Tanya forgot her dreams of becoming a doctor and embarked on a relentless war against the enemy, whom she always referred to as sticks that one broke because she refused to think of them as human beings. As a partisan, she had broken several sticks in the forests of Byelorussia and the Ukraine. The experience had hardened her outlook on life, and she looked forward with enthusiasm to renewing her vendetta in Stalingrad. The sky suddenly filled with red and orange balls of flame as the barge struggled laboriously through ugly waterspouts toward a landing point somewhere near the Red October plant. Tanya started talking to two men, one about 50 and the other more her age, when a German plane dropped a bomb squarely in the center of the craft. Tanya and her two comrades flew into the water and came up swimming for the Stalingrad shore. As they fought to stay afloat, the current carried them further downstream. Tanya finally dragged herself onto a sandbar on the west bank of the river and ducked into a sewer outlet. The other two soldiers followed. They had no idea where they were or who controlled the land above them. Hoping to find an exit in safe territory, the three walked on in the blackened sewer. Their footsteps echoed hollowly as they felt their way. The stench made them gag. Excrement clung to their shoes and pants. When the old man fainted, Tanya and her friend dragged him for a while, but exhausted and nauseous themselves, they left him lying in the filth. Finally, they climbed out of a manhole somewhere in the city. Tanya saw a group of soldiers, mess tins in hand, lining up in front of a building. Famished, they got in line. A soldier turned around, his nose wrinkling in disgust. "What in God's name is that smell?" He spoke in German. Tanya decided to bluff her way through. Pretending not to hear him, she kept her place. In the mess hall, Tanya and her companion sat side by side with Germans who complained bitterly about the sickening aroma. Somebody shouted, "What is that rotten stench?" Tanya wrinkled her nose too. A German officer suddenly recognized her as a Russian. Before he could react, a Russian cook rushed over to assure him she worked for the German army. The officer ordered the two out, but the friendly cook took them into the kitchen and fed them. The German came back again and demanded they leave because they stank so badly. Still defiant, the two pariahs calmly walked out of the mess hall and searched for the Russian lines. At nightfall, they crawled through no man's land and met their countrymen, who gave them clean clothes, a drink, and new rifles. The German 71st Division continued to advance slowly toward the main ferry. Only a few places like the Dragon Strongpoint still held out, and they made the cost frightful. On the morning of September 25th, at the intersection of Krasnopeterskaya Street, Dragon had 10 men left. During the previous night, two of his 12 men had deserted. A lieutenant and a private slipped out, ran down to the river, and made off on a raft. Only the lieutenant reached headquarters on the other side. Anxious to cover his tracks and convinced that the 1st Battalion was doomed, he reported everyone dead and said he personally had buried Anton Dragon near the Volga. But in his fortress, Anton Dragon was munching burned grain and waiting for the Germans to rush him. They came again, and Dragon's men threw their last grenades and heaved bricks through the windows. When the sound of a tank motor suddenly was heard, Dragon sent a soldier out with an anti-tank rifle and the last three shells. The Germans quickly seized him. An hour later, an enemy platoon appeared directly in front of Dragon's machine gun. Immediately assuming the captured man had told the Germans this was the defender's blind spot, Dragon fired his last 250 bullets at the enemy. Finally out of ammunition and wounded in the hand by return fire, he propped himself up and stared numbly at the rows of dead men in the street. Shortly afterward, the nine Russian holdouts heard some Germans calling to them from outside. When they peeked out, they saw their captured comrade being pushed onto a pile of debris. While the 1st Battalion looked on, a German shot him in the head. Shaking hands and embracing, the nine Russians in the house said goodbye to each other. Dragon's orderly, Laborius, scratched on a wall, "Redimsev's guardsmen fought and died for their country here." German tanks, black and squat, came around a corner and fired directly into the building. Something hit Dragon in the head and he passed out. When he woke up, it was dark and his orderly was grabbing at him. The building had fallen down, but in the basement, the six survivors called each other's names. Buried alive, the air going fast, their only hope was to dig their way out. Their wounds aching and their teeth caked with accumulated dust and grime, they kept clawing at the rubble. Suddenly a cool breeze hit them, and they saw stars in the autumn sky. Dragon sent a man out to reconnoiter. He returned in an hour with the news that Germans were all around, so the men cautiously left the house one by one. To their left, they heard the vicious rolling gunfire on Mamaev and saw the fireworks of tracer bullets. The smell of cordite was heavy, but on Komsomolskaya Street, it was relatively quiet. The Germans owned the Volga there. When patrols nearly stumbled upon them, Dragon's group came back to the ruins. They waited again until the moon was obscured. Then, silhouetted by flames from railroad cars and houses, they edged closer to the river. Another patrol passed in front of them. When one German lingered by a truck, Dragon sent a man to kill him. The Russian buried a knife in him, put on the German's greatcoat, and approached another patrolling soldier, whom he also knifed. Suddenly, the way to the river was open. the Russians scurried across the railway line and fell to the ground at the edge of the Volga. Their lips cracking from the cold water, they drank and drank. Above them, the Germans discovered the dead bodies. While the Russians feverishly constructed a small raft from logs and sticks, the Germans fired at random toward the river. Dragon and his men finally pushed off into the current and drifted downstream. Just before dawn, their raft bumped ashore on Sarpinsky Island, where Russian artillerymen found them, hollow-eyed, in rags, but alive. Dragon ate his first food in 3 days, fish, soup, and bread, then reported the presence of the 6th men of his 1st battalion. The rest lay dead around Red Square. On that square, bodies sprawled grotesquely across the grass and sidewalks. Crimson puddles marked where they fell. Other trails of blood etched crazy patterns on the streets, showing where men had dragged themselves to cover. The Univermag was desolate, smashed. Window mannequins had tumbled in awkward positions. Bullets stitched paths up and down their lifeless forms. Inside, Russians and Germans huddled in death along the aisles. The store had become a morgue. The Pravda building had collapsed in the bombings of August 23rd. The City Soviet, the Red Army Club, and the Gorky Theater were now vacant, ugly from blackened holes and gaping windows. On side streets, merchants' stores had been flattened. Rotted tomatoes and watermelon pulp splashed over the sidewalks. Fragments of bodies mixed with the vegetables. Flies swarmed over the remains. In what once had been a fashionable restaurant just east of the mouth of Tsaritsa Gorge, Russian doctors and nurses struggled to evacuate the wounded. More than 700 victims had gone out the day before by boat, a motley collection of vessels that were barely seaworthy and which landed under the fire from the German 71st Division. Now, nearly 600 more victims were being carried to the shoreline. The Germans crept closer. Their machine guns sprayed a withering fire into the masses huddled at the dock. Russian soldiers formed a defense line and held the Nazis off until the last patients crawled feebly on board. When the Germans finally broke into the restaurant, they vomited from the stench of ether and blood and of those who had died and lay unburied. At last, the main ferry had been taken. Except for isolated pockets of resistance, the German 6th Army held the Volga shoreline for several miles north and south of the Tsaritsa Gorge. Only the factory district in northern Stalingrad remained to be conquered. At Vinnytsia, this good news failed to stir Adolf Hitler, who sulked bitterly in his log cabin. For more than 2 weeks after his explosive argument with General Jodl, the Führer had refused to socialize with the men who served him. Enraged by the insubordination within his staff, disgusted with the lack of progress in the Caucasus and along the Volga, on September 24th, he met with Franz Halder and fired him. In an icy voice, Hitler told the general that they both needed a rest, that their nerves had frayed to the point where neither could help the other. Halder bowed out gracefully and went to his quarters to pack. But before departing, he wrote a short note to his friend and pupil, Friedrich von Paulus, out on the steppe. 24 September 1942. A line to tell you that today I have resigned my appointment. Let me thank you, my dear Paulus, for your loyalty and friendship, and wish you further success as the leader you have proved yourself to be. As always, Halder. Paulus received Halder's letter just as his soldiers raised a huge swastika over the pockmarked entrance to the Univermag department store in the central part of the city. But Paulus had no desire to celebrate, for he had just learned the staggering cost of the 6 weeks' passage from the Don to the banks of the Volga. More than 7,700 German soldiers dead, 31,000 wounded. 10% of the 6th Army had been lost. Moreover, he knew the worst battle had not yet been joined. North of the ferry landing, north of heavily contested Mamive Hill, lay the key to the city, the factories. There, the 6th Army faced the ultimate challenge, and Paulus was running out of men and ammunition. Returning to his isolated quarters at Golubinka on the high western bank of the Don, he listened to his gramophone and tried to quell his dysentery. A tick on his cheek had become almost uncontrollable. Paulus sent another urgent cable to Army Group B. Rifle strength in the city failing more rapidly than reinforcements. Unless decline halted, the battle will stretch on. Some of Paulus's men shared his increasing gloom. One of them was Lieutenant Hans Otel, who had become a forward observer on the front lines a few miles north of the tractor plant. Each day, Otel looked through his field glasses and pinpointed Russian positions. His batteries fired barrages of shells over his head, down onto the enemy. It had gone on like this for weeks, and nothing had shaken the Russians loose. Opposite him, Russian militiamen had been replaced by seasoned troops ferried across the Volga at night. For Odal, there was a sharp awareness that the war was not ending as abruptly as he had hoped. He had also come to realize that the young officers in his division were woefully inadequate. Though many wore the Order of the Ritterkreuz on their breast, few, if any, had ever received training in the art of street fighting. They were dying at an alarming rate. During lulls in the fighting, Odal rested in his bunker and worried about the future. Outside, his red-ribboned goat, Maidi, grazed contentedly, oblivious to the gunfire that never seemed to stop. At Vertaichi, out on the steppe, Deputy Chief Quartermaster Karl Binder plunged into his new job, supplying the men of the 305th Division from the Lake Constant region of southern Germany. Well-fed, gregarious, a veteran of the German army since the days of the Freikorps before Hitler, Binder immediately noticed the poor morale of the units in the northernmost sector held by 6th Army. They were unwashed, discouraged, and begging for decent rations. When Binder inquired into the reasons for their condition, he was told the enemy constantly harassed them, never giving them a chance to rest. Russian artillery dropped hundreds of shells into the German lines. Russian divisions mounted brief, small infantry attacks. Although the Russians failed to gain ground, they inflicted a mounting toll of casualties. Binder took hold of his new job swiftly. Within days, the experienced scrounger found sausages and beer, pumpernickel, even wine for his men. In the officers' quarters, he learned more about the battle on the steppe. One of the staff, Lieutenant Colonel Kodry, warned, "Stalingrad will still give the Germans the shock of their lives because the Russians are far from beaten." Kodry went on, "A nagging worry for us is the supply line back to the Ukraine. The 6th Army requires 750 tons a day to survive, and all of it comes over a single track to the railhead at Chir." Sobered by these comments, Karl Binder began to worry more about that tenuous lifeline to the rear. In the meantime,